You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Kathy Batista. She's the Program Director of Contemporary Art at Sotheby's Institute of Art in New York. And she's also a curator and a writer, and we'll talk about that as well. Kathy, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's begin with, what is it exactly that's happening at Sotheby's Institute of Art in New York in regard to what you're doing? What is your position there, and what do you do?
Well, I was teaching at Sotheby's Institute in London when they decided to open a New York Institute, and so they invited me to establish a contemporary art MA program. And so I moved to New York to set that up. We're now in our eighth year, and we have an intake of about 30 students every fall, and they stay with us for 18 months, and they get an MA in contemporary art. The title is a little problematic because people often say to me, what is contemporary art? And the way we approach it at Sotheby's Institute, it's a combination of art history, I would say about 50 to 60%, and then the rest is professional practice. So they learn about things such as the history of the market and emerging markets, and they can also elect to take things such as curating or auction business classes, or even art law or business classes. And that was one of the things I was really excited about in setting up the New York program, was that there could be more interdisciplinarity. So when I was teaching in London, students who were on the art business track could not dip into contemporary art. It was only what they were exposed to on their course, and vice versa. Whereas in New York, we set it up so that art business students can take my courses, and my students can take art business or fine and decorative arts courses, which deals more with the history of fine and decorative arts in America.
The students in your classes are artists. They're not necessarily academics. I mean, these are often working artists that are either going to develop their own careers, or are they going into arts administration as well of some kind?
Some of the students are artists. Many of them, I would say probably 70% of them, are actually art history undergrads or other subjects, such as many of them will have an English lit undergrad or economics with an art history minor. But I think that many of them see it as a terminal degree. I have had students who go on to PhD programs, and that has been quite a struggle in setting up our program in New York because obviously people didn't know it. So it was a big push to get people into further education after ours. In London, we had a very good track record because the Institute had been running there for 40 years. So it was much easier to get people through to PhD programs there. But my students, most of them are art historians or other liberal arts backgrounds. Some of them are artists. And some of them are career changers. So every year I have one or two who have been lawyers or accountants or marketing execs, and they want to go into the art world, and they see this as a bridge.
And so when we talk about professional practice, when you talk about professional practice, mm-hmm. is that for all of those fields, or is that mainly for working artists, that notion of professional practice?
Everyone. So my art history, they all enter together, and the first semester they all do the same classes. And one of the things I do with them in the very beginning is take them to an artist studio, because I was an art historian. I was trained as one, and I had never, until my PhD program, gone into artist studios. I was always taught in a dark classroom with slides. And I went to the Courtauld, which has one of the best collections, you know, best small collections of art in the world. And we never went into the galleries as a formal group. So one of the things that I consider professional practice is going out to biennales and to artist studios and to galleries and talking to professionals and to artists and having the students learn how to be a professional, because I don't think it's just about working in a gallery. It's also about how do you talk to an artist in their studio and how do you foster a relationship that hopefully will last for many years. It's not one studio visit and you throw their work into a curated show and, you know, we sell it. And, you know, I think many of my students come in with this idea of the booming art market, and you go into artist studios and you find the work and then you get it out and you sell it. And I try to, and I would say my faculty very much as well, try to instill this idea that you develop long-term relationships with artists, either whether you're going to be a curator or a writer or a gallery director or owner, that, you know, we try to instill in them this idea that it's, you know, it's a long-term relationship. But being close to the artist is very important for me in teaching contemporary art to my students, because it was something that I didn't have experience of. And I really felt if I had had that experience earlier, my career might have changed.
That's interesting. And I want to go back and talk about your career. But I want to ask you also about, what you're just mentioning is, it sounds like professional development for, you know, for people who may want to be curators or go into those levels of the art world that are different from actually being a professional artist.
Mm-hmm.
Are you also teaching professional artists how to act professionally and presumably build their career and sell their work and make relationships with curators and galleries?
I suppose in a roundabout way, yes. But the thing that I have found with my artists who come in is they come in with a fine art degree, and most of the time they leave and they want to support or enable other artists rather than have their own practice. So some of my former students who were artists have gone on to run nonprofit spaces like Galapagos in Brooklyn, or to many of them are starting to work for other artist studios, especially some of the big studios that employ, you know, scores of people. That's a popular one for people who were fine artists. We don't particularly market ourselves as artist professional educators, because most of the thing we see is putting people into careers in the arts rather than an art career per se. But I have had artists who've gone through and then decide to go back to art practice.
Huh, because that is, in a way, an element that we don't see much. You know, from Yale to colleges across the country, professional practice for artists is something that's just beginning, and in many places is still not even considered something that's important.
Absolutely.
It's often quite a shock. I mean, at Yale, and I've interviewed Robert Storen and other people, it seems shocking to a lot of people that there's absolutely no support for what an artist does when they leave Yale or most other colleges, UCLA with an MFA, and try to make it in the world. They haven't a clue.
I agree, and I think it's something I'm very interested in, because I'm just always interested in working with artists. I see so many artists who come out of art school and they're making great stuff and they really don't know how to price it or monetize it or how to negotiate with galleries. And personally, I came out of the courtold and I felt very much like that person coming out of art school. It had never been discussed ever what you might actually do with your education. You were just in classrooms learning about art history. And I came out into this total vacuum. And, you know, I was waitressing tables with a master's degree thinking, what am I going to do? Where am I going to work for free in London? So I think it's really important for artists. And I think now that the market is expanding as well and this big boom, that it's really easy to get kind of lost for an artist. And so I think it's very important that they have these professional skills. But I can understand how some art schools resist it, because in a way you want them to just take that time and develop their practice and not worry too much about what's going to happen afterward. But I think that's a very old-fashioned way of education. And I just think the way our economy is and the way the world is now, that you have to get out and hit the ground running. It's very hard unless you have some sort of, you know, family backing to just go out and move into a studio and keep making work for years and wait for someone to discover you.
Right, exactly. Well, I think really perhaps both can be taught. I feel like it is important to focus on their practice and not think of the market at the same time. That very notion of what it means to be thinking too much about the market, I think is important to address. When I was talking to interviewing a director at Barbara Gladstone, and, you know, interestingly enough, he said something that I thought probably resonated with a lot of people. He said, when I look for artists, I'm looking for sincerity. I'm looking for someone who's not just thinking about the market. I'm looking for someone who's just thinking about their work and what they want to do. And he said, of course, everybody wants to sell their work and make money, but if the work looks like it's meant just to sell and make money, that's not very interesting for him or most people. And I feel like, why can't students be taught that too? You know, that because that's an aspect of professional development, to not put yourself out there as someone who is purely a commodity in trying to appease the market.
Yes, I agree. And I think that I think it's tough for students in art school because, you know, now even the collectors and the advisors, they go to the MFA shows, right, and they buy. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But these students are exposed earlier and earlier to the market anyway. So I do think there is space for it in art education. And I know some programs are starting to think this way and really trying to change. I think USC has undergone a little bit of this in their fine arts program. But, you know, it's a big change. So I guess implementing that kind of education in larger universities is more difficult. With Sotheby's Institute, we're so small and we're almost like a startup. You know, each campus has 100 students and LA has even less than that. So it's very easy for us to be responsive to changes that happen. So when Jeffrey Deitch became director of MoCA, we had a special session for students where we discussed what does that mean for a gallery director and an art dealer to become head of a museum. And, you know, smaller institutions, I think, can make those changes easier than big universities. But hopefully it will come.
Yes, I hope so. So let's move back a little bit. I'd like to talk about, trace your career a little bit. So you've gotten your MFA, you're waiting on tables thinking, what's happening next? What does happen next for you at that time?
Well, I got an MA, not an MFA. I got an MA from the Courtauld, and I was applying to PhD programs at the time. And I was looking for an internship, and I couldn't even get a free internship to work for free. And I see this now with my students. And so one of the things we have today is a very developed system for placing people in different internships. But so I really got my first internship, which was at Camden Arts Centre, which is an excellent nonprofit in London. And through being at an opening and meeting someone whose wife was the head of the education there. And I mentioned to him, oh, I had written a letter because I wanted to do a free internship. And then, you know, suddenly she wrote back to me because I had the introduction through her husband. So I got a free internship. And then after 8 months, when the first job came up, they gave me the job. And then within another year, I was running the department because this woman and her husband had another child. So it was really quite lucky. And you know, I think I tell that to my students all the time, is that you just need to get your foot in the door. And if you're working hard and you have a good attitude, you know, and you get your foot in the door, even working for free, people hold on to good workers, you know, and people with good attitudes. And so that's always been my game plan, is to work hard and to use the education I've gotten and to not have, you know, an attitude and to just try to contribute. And I think people, you know, I think that goes far. I try to tell my students all the time, you know, don't think you don't have to work really hard for the next 20 years of your life.
Right, right. And so when you became, you said you were directing the program there at that nonprofit. What were your responsibilities mm-hmm. then? And is that when you began curating and learning about curatorial practice?
Yes, well, it was a tiny team. So the exhibition organizer, we didn't even have a curator, and the education were in the same office. So it was, you know, really a small team, like a family. And that's when I started to work with people like Dan Graham. We would have shows, Rose and Kelsey, who sadly departed last year. But I would work quite closely with them because the education was very integrated from the beginning. And it was really exciting. I basically did everything from two-year-olds to college students and adult education. So it was a great kind of, you know, launch into the deep end of art education. And then I started my PhD, so I had to focus on that for a little while. And then Art Angel offered me to set up their education program, which was really exciting because that was, you know, tabula rasa and for a public art agency, which means you don't have the same kind of expectations as when you're in a nonprofit built environment where you have to have the same school group needs to come four times a year. You have that sort of regularity and continuity. With Art Angel, it was totally new, every project, every time. And again, it was a tiny team and we didn't have a curator and we had production people, but everyone would just pitch in. So when the head of production would be working with the Kabakovs and I was there, I would work with them too. You know, it was just these small teams. I think small places can be really great for learning because you can suddenly do a lot and get a lot of hands-on experience. So at Art Angel, I set up the program, which was super exciting. My first project was the Kabakovs, and then I stayed for 5 years. I ended with this kind of big season we had for an anniversary, and we had at the same time Matthew Barney, Richard Wentworth, Steve McQueen, and our book that was the result of many years. So that was really exciting.
Wow.
And then after that, I decided that I really needed to focus on the academic stuff or I was never going to finish the PhD. So since then, I've been doing more academic things, and then I do my curatorial stuff independently.
So now we go from what you were doing with Art Angel, which was, and that was essentially producing public art projects. Is that correct?
Yes, they produce public art projects in unusual spaces. So, for example, they were the people responsible for Rachel White Reid's house when she cast a house in the East End of London. You might remember it was a big controversial project. Yes, that was right before I came on. And we always worked in unusual spaces. So it was very exciting. And you work really closely with artists. And some of the artists, like Jeremy Deller, you know, when they were local, they would be in the office all the time. So it was really good fun. And that was really also, I learned so much from James Lingwood and Michael Morris, the co-directors there, about working with artists and developing long-term relationships. Some of the projects took, you know, 7 years to develop. And so you'd really see an artist career change. We worked with Steve McQueen. When we started with him, he was a kid practically. He was young and we were young. And then by the time we had his project, I think I can't remember if he won the Turner Prize, but he was getting much more recognition because it just took so long for these projects to evolve. But I really learned how to work with artists and how to be patient and also how to, you know, guide things without being an overlord curator. And also I learned, you know, every project had to be fundraised from the ground up. Basically, we had no money. We had just the operating costs of the institution and every project would be fundraised. So I really learned to kind of appreciate when something could happen.
And you also had to learn how to fundraise as well?
I didn't really have to, thank God. We always had a fundraiser. I would have to write reports or, you know, certain grants that were specific to education, but I would never say I learned how to fundraise. But we had some very, we had a something, will they still do, I believe, called the Company of Angels, where they have people who donate every year a certain amount of money, like a membership program, but there the angels are a smaller number. It's not like the Royal Academy where you have 50,000 members. And so the angels were wonderful people themselves, people like Marina Warner and Jeremy King, who owns the Ivy and many restaurants. And these people were very much involved too. So I also got to learn how to work with people from other disciplines, but that could be very, it could be very amenable to both sides. So, you know, working with restaurateurs or TV presenters or people like Marina Warner who are academics and novelists, you know, I learned that when you're working in the visual arts, it's really interesting to expand your circle of reference because people like Brian Eno can bring a lot to a project, you know. And I really, I mean, that sense of interdisciplinarity is something I'm really interested in still.
So then what happened next? Then was it next that you co-founded a curatorial agency, or what was your next step?
No, then I was finishing my PhD, and I was teaching at many different places, one of them being the PhD program I was on, the London Consortium, which was an amazing program. It was, again, interdisciplinary. So I was with people who were architects or film theorists and curators. It was great fun. But then I was also teaching at the Ruskin School of Art at Oxford, which Richard Wentworth was the master of. And again, Richard was someone I'd worked with for a year intensely at Art Angel, and we're still very close friends. And so he said, come teach with me. I want someone like you to teach my students. And it was very exciting at Oxford, I have to say. I mean, the first time they handed in essays, I said to Richard, I think we have a problem with plagiarism. And he said to me, no, Kathy, these are the top students in the world. So, you know, the level is so high. And it was really exciting to be working with artists who were, you know, who could write and think and, you know, really, really just indulge in the act of making art. There wasn't a lot of professional practice going on there, but there was a lot of thinking. And the interesting thing for me about teaching in the UK, both in arts management programs and in art practice, because I also taught at Birkbeck and King's College in arts management programs, was that there didn't seem to be such an essay on goals such as grades. People really were more apt to fail. And I don't know if that was because education was less expensive than here, where students take on so much debt. But one thing I really noticed when I came to America was that there was this obsession over results. And that that made me wish I could give up grades altogether for my students, because I think that this obsession with the grade, you know, makes people sometimes not enjoy the path getting there.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I mean, I went to, that reminds me of when I was in, I went to undergraduate school at SUNY Purchase, and Jan Gruber, the photographer, who's quite well known at that time, ran a rather notorious class where, you know, she also used to smoke in the class, breaking a lot of rules. And the students, I was in the class where the students were saying, you know, well, you know, how are you doing the grades? You know, will you know, does attendance affect the grade? Does this affect the grade? And she said, okay, everybody, this is the story with grades. Everybody's got an A. You can come to this class or not. You can leave right now, but everybody's got an A. So those who want to stay here and learn can, and the rest of you can leave and feel good that you got an A.
It's so
really
smart.
But it made us all
so
think,
smart.
Like, yeah, why are we here? You know, it's like, do we want to be in this class because we're interested, or is it about the grade? You know, and when the grade's out of the way, it does make you think, why am I here? You know, and apply
it,
or not.
It does. It does. And I really saw more sense of experimentation when I was at places like the Ruskin. I'm not sure if they even had grades, or if I can't recall, or I have a feeling I just I would just give them feedback. I don't think they had grades, actually. I think they get a report. But anyway, it just seemed like so much more of an intellectual endeavor. And, you know, that's one thing that being in the States, when I came over after a few years of being entrenched in academia in London and Oxford, to come here was so, in a strange way, much more formal. The whole system of, you know, requirements and grading. And, yeah, my PhD supervisor would give lectures every Friday night at the Architectural Association, and he would be drinking a gin and tonic and smoking as he gave the lecture. And that's what a tutorial would be like. But he was an amazing mind. I learned so much that way, you know. And so I do worry a little bit, you know, sometimes I feel like, am I part of a problem where we're churning out graduates in this country and their, you know, their main goal is to pass the course, get an A or a B plus, and then get a job. And I really want them to think about the time that they're spending. I always say to them, this is one of the few times in your life you're going to be able to just do research for a year or 18 months and just read. So try to enjoy it, you know. But there is this real pressure, I think, in this country. And part of that is the tuition and the debt that students take on, which I'm also very aware of, you know. And this real reticence for experimentation because no one wants to fail.
Right. It's very interesting because you have that experience both coming from the United States and going to England and coming back. So you really have a nice point of view on both cultures because you were born and raised in the United States, correct?
Yes, and then I was in London for 13 years for all of my graduate school and postdoc. I did a 2-year postdoc at Tate Modern through my PhD program, and that was a lot of fun. I worked in the education department at Tate Modern for 2 years doing a project that was all about London, and we would have a sort of think tank summer school each summer. And when I came to New York to set up the program, we were actually a UK-accredited institution. So our governance was by the University of Manchester. That was part of the reason they wanted me, because I understood the UK system. And then we applied for New York accreditation, which we now have. So we don't have the relationship with Manchester anymore in New York. In the UK, our London branch is still associated with Manchester. But the great thing about, the one good thing, I loved having colleagues at Manchester. You know, the art history department was wonderful. Amelia Jones was there. I'm trying to think who else. A surrealist expert, he was wonderful. And I loved them as colleagues because they would come over and we would go there. But the great thing about being New York accredited has meant that we can introduce some different ways of examining students. So now, instead of a thesis, students can do a practical project. And for me, if you ask me, I think that is much more valuable for some students than writing a 50-page paper. Because if you know you're not going to go on to do a PhD, maybe curating a show or making a business plan or creating a new app is a much more valuable exercise. And now my students can do that, which is really exciting.
That is exciting. And so for yourself, now we're coming back to this country at the end of your years in England. You're developing your curatorial practice and you're beginning to write more. In 2006 or even earlier?
Well, when I first came back, the first 2 years, I hardly published because I was setting up a program from scratch. I had no faculty, nothing. So those 2 years were pretty intensive. And then about 2009, it got a bit better because I started to have faculty and things just fell into place more. And so then I was able to turn my PhD into a book. That's The Renegotiating the Body, which was very exciting for me because I felt that I'd spent a lot of time combing through artists' personal archives, literally sometimes under their bed or in kitchens, in back sheds in England. And I felt this awesome responsibility that these artists had spent so much time with me that I wanted to make sure that the work got out into the world. So that book, for me, I was really proud of just getting it out into the world. And then since then, two of the artists in the book passed away last year. So that was very sad for me because, again, I developed very close relationships with the artists that were in my PhD because most of them had been underrecognized. The whole point was that I wanted to look at a period in the UK that hadn't been covered in depth the way it had been here. And the two artists in it that most people would know are Carly Schneeman and Mary Kelly because they actually lived in the UK during the 70s. So they're in the book. But most of the other artists are pretty unknown here. And in the UK, they're getting better known. And it was very exciting because, for example, Linda is now represented by Modern Art. So she had a solo booth at Frieze this May. I don't know if you noticed that. But it's interesting also how when I started this project in the late 90s, my PhD supervisor said to me, no one is interested in feminist art. It's such awful art. No one cares. And I just wanted to do it. So I said, I'm going to stick with this because it's what I'm interested in. And now it's, you know, it's kind of having a resurgence. Of course, there have been so many big shows, you know, Global Feminisms and WAC, and now it's entering the market, interestingly. So I feel like, you know, my main area of research is that, and my new book is a follow-up on that, which looks at the legacy of feminist art in emerging practitioners, but not just women. There are also transgender and gay artists in the book.
So that's very interesting. That's the book you're working on right now?
Mm-hmm. It's almost done. I took a little excursion out the past year to work on the EAT project, but basically this book will be out by the fall or the spring, and it's called New York New Wave, The Legacy of Feminist Art in Emerging Practice.
Oh, that
and
sounds
I'm really
like a fascinating.
Excited.
Yeah,
yeah,
I would be too.
I'm very excited because, you know, when I was working in the 70s, it was always this thing, as my PhD supervisor would say, why is this relevant now? Which is a very good question to ask. And at that time, I said, because it's a history that I believe needs to be told. But in the new book, I think it's so fascinating for me because it's more linked to what is going on really now. So, you know, the artists that I've been speaking to, you know, we talk about things like Beyonce and Lady Gaga because feminism is strangely very relevant still, especially now with transgender culture and the Caitlyn, thing going on with Vanity Fair. It's amazing how feminism keeps coming up again and again, and it's in no way resolved. And I'm also very excited about the artists, of course, that aren't necessarily female, that are engaging with feminist topics. So, you know, it's something I don't get to do too much of at Sotheby's because we have so much ground to cover. But on my own, it's my main topic of interest.
That's very exciting. And I look forward to that book. And you're curating something now, too. What's your most recent curatorial project?
So it's a retrospective of the work of Experiments in Art and Technology, and it's a group that was established in the 60s by Robert Rauschenberg and Robert Whitman and two Bell Labs engineers, Billy Kluver and Fred Waldhauer. And so I've been working with Kluver and Waldhauer's families and with the Rauschenberg Foundation and with Bob Whitman, who happily is still alive, and many other artists who were involved. And the idea of this group that they set up was to have technology experts working with artists to see what they came up with. And they came up with quite a lot of radical and amazing stuff. And it was a fairly chaotic group. And, you know, they did this this quite famous event series called Nine Evenings in 1966. And then they did a big pavilion in Japan for the World Expo in 1970. And they also did some more esoteric projects. But shows have been done about EAT before. So, for example, Catherine Morris, a curator now at the Brooklyn Museum, she did a great show at the MIT List in 2006 about Nine Evenings. But this is the first show to do a retrospective look at all their activities. So it starts with a single engineer, Billy Kluver, working with Jean Tungley, and then the formation of the group and the major events as well as the minor events, and also looks at how the group dissipates over time. Because eventually technology just became so ensconced in our daily lives, it's not a special thing anymore. I mean, art and technology are completely merged. Hans Ulrich Obrist, who interviewed Billy Kluver while he was still alive, has a new project called NEAT, N-E-A-T. I can't remember what it stands for. I think it's New Experiments in Art and Technology, which looks at artists born after 1989. And I think it's exciting because I love doing archival projects, but also I think it's so relevant to many young artists today, what these people were doing in the 1960s, which was really pushing the boundaries and was really quite edgy. Because I think a lot of people are doing that today in different ways, you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, many of the younger artists that I'm interested in, and also there are many artists that the market is interested in, are dealing with this so-called post-internet age we live in. I still
and
don't believe we're in a post-internet age, but...
Right, it doesn't feel like it's post-internet yet.
Exactly.
And when will that show open, and where will that be?
It's at the Museum der Moderne in Salzburg, Austria, and it opens on July 25th, so I'm heading out next week to install it. And it's going to be great because we also have David Tudor, who worked quite closely with Cage. Cage and Tudor were both part of EAT, and Tudor's trust... two men from his trust are performing some of his original pieces, and we're having a symposium. So it's a whole weekend of activities, and we've published a 250-page book in German and English. So it's been quite a year. This was my diversion from my new book, but it was a really great diversion. And Sabina Breitweiser, who invited me to be part of the project, is the director at that museum, and it's amazing that she's been able to get this together. It's an exhibition that really should happen in America, and it's interesting that it's happening in Austria, but I think it's so visionary of her to host this.
I think so, too. I'd love to see that here. Kathy, I wish you the best of luck on that show, and I wish I could come see it. Perhaps I will. I'd like to think I'll take a trip out there. I want to thank you for talking with us today. I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. It was great to meet you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.